The following programming is sponsored by MBC Media. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
Stand by, fire!
Again, live from Philadelphia, 860 AM, WWDB Radio. This is Project Chaos, show number 18. You know, the mission of Project Chaos is to uncover the truth about what it's like to serve in our military so that we can understand our history and remember it. And it's important for a few reasons, not the least of which, that we need to remember the sacrifices that have been made for this country, that we don't take it for granted. And you've heard me talk about this before, the price of freedom. They say freedom isn't free, and it's not. And if you listen to me talk about it, you know that I've said the cost is 1.3 million. 1.3 million veterans that have given their lives defending this country. The price goes way beyond that. We're going to talk a little bit more about that today as well. Those that were injured, the families that suffered along with them. It's an enormous burden. If you want to see a little bit of what it looks like firsthand, you can get a glimpse of the scale of that at Arlington National Cemetery. Covers 628 acres. You get down there and stand any point in that cemetery, and you can look any direction as far as the eye can see, perfectly aligned in every direction. You'll see the crosses lined up of those 1.3 million veterans that have paid that ultimate price. One of those crosses at Arlington marks the grave of Michael Crescens. He's an Army veteran from Philadelphia. And today, I want to tell you his story. You might know that the Philadelphia Veterans Hospital is named the Corporal Michael J. Crescens Department of Veterans Affairs Medical Center. In Philadelphia, there's also a Vietnam Veterans Memorial, and in that park is a giant bronze statue of Corporal Crescens. Who was this guy? Where is he from? What's he about? Well, it's an amazing story. Before I get to his story, there's a couple of important things that you should know that was going on at that time. Many veterans, especially from Philadelphia, paid a heavy price in Vietnam. I've seen it reported. I haven't verified it, but I'm told that more veterans lost their lives in Vietnam from the Philadelphia area than any other place in the country. Guys cut down by gunfire, horrible, painful deaths in many cases, huge, huge sacrifices. And that's let alone the ones that were wounded and came back with scars and pain and difficulties their whole lives. Then there's the ones that just never came back, never showed up, disappeared in the jungles, their families lost, their lives gone forever. That pain that was felt by the entire community of military families was carefully respected. The sacrifice of every one of our Vietnam veterans is critical to remember. Michael Crescens' story is part of a much larger story, and his legacy is the legacy the Vietnam veterans, especially from Philadelphia, those who fought and sacrificed dearly along with so many families. It was back in November of 1968, Corporal Crescens was deep in the jungle of Vietnam. He was in I Corps. You've heard me talk about this. This was along the border of North Vietnam. It was a Marine-controlled sector staffed by Marines and Army Infantry and Army Air Cavalry. Every day for these veterans, Army, Marines, it was a grind. What do I mean by that? Well, typically it meant getting shot at to begin with. Travel was risky. You heard John Podlasky come on the show and talk about the nets over the windows. There was no glass. He asked what that was for in case there was any grenades that might end up in their direction. Trucks were targets. If you know Mission Barbecue, they showcase the hardened deuce and a halfs that were used in Vietnam. That hardening of those trucks was key that they could move anything. The grunts, like Michael Crescens, they slept on the jungle ground, the wet, damp ground, constantly wet and miserable. Bugs, snakes, lots of bullets. Literally about as close to hell as you're ever going to experience. Corporal Crescens was a rifleman with an infantry company. His job was very simple. If you were to read the manual, it would say that his job was to engage the enemy. What I would say is they were hunters. They were going to hunt the North Vietnamese fighters. They would go out and they would pick fights. And on this day, they were taking a mountain that was occupied by NVA fighters, dug in all kinds of fighting holes and tunnels. And what this meant, basically, in simple terms, that as the platoon tried to move through the jungle, heavy jungle, all full of greenery and forest, cutting their way through everything, as they tried to move through that, a machine gun nest could pop up out of nowhere and just disappear just as easily. They knew they were out there, but they greatly underestimated how many. So there they are, this infantry company. They've got rifles, they've got water, and they got to go find these NVA fighters and kill them. 19, 20-year-old American young men, probably about 100 of these guys, out on this hill. There they were, marching with their heavy packs in the jungle to go kill the NVA and the machine gun nests and take the hill. The company likely consisted of riflemen, mortars, machine guns. They would have had air support, maybe even artillery support. We don't know. They barely get onto the mountain. They get off the trail, and they barely just get started on this mission, and all hell breaks loose. They had no idea how many NVA were shooting at them. Bullets flying everywhere, guys getting hit. At least one guy got hit. The doc, we call him Corman, the doc, runs up to this guy. The Corman gets pinned down while he's holding this guy. The guy's hit, bleeding. Doc gets to him. Now they're both pinned down. Doc's got this guy. They're pinned down. While they're pinned down, Doc's like holding his head to the ground so the guy doesn't lift his head an inch or he's going to get shot and killed, both of them. While they're laying there like that, trying to blend in with the ground, the same guy gets shot again. Bullets everywhere, noise, total chaos. You want to know what matters next? Sight aperture. Somebody's got to take a shot. That's exactly what happened. Young Michael Crescens, he put down his rifle, and he picked up an M60. If you don't know, M60 is a heavy crew-served machine gun, never shot from the hip. Always shot from a tripod or a vehicle. Really the only way to shoot it properly unless you're a pretty big guy. Well, Michael was. He picked it up, threw the belt of ammo over his shoulder, and stormed the first enemy fighting position, firing at it with the M60 while they're firing at him from multiple positions. He stands up, runs to the machine gun nest, successfully killing both NVA fighters in the first hole. This is all in a very tight environment. This whole story took place over about 100 yards, a football field in length. So he would have ran up not very far. That's how close the NVA fighters, I mean, this is, I don't know, danger close, whatever you're going to call it, point blank range. He gets up to the second hole with the M60, takes out the second hole in the same fashion. Now he gets to Doc. Doc's laying on the ground, trying to figure out what's going on. Michael Crescens says to him, he leans down and he says, "I got this." Takes the M60, he charges the third hole. I get a little fuzzy on this part. At some point, either before the third hole or the fourth hole, he gets shot in the thigh. Now, let's just talk about that little injury a second. This would have been a round, traveling at, however many feet per second. It's hot when it comes out of the barrel. You ever been hit by the hot brass coming out of the rifle? Well, it's the same thing with the projectile. He just got a massive wound, probably took out half the muscle in his upper leg. He keeps going. Third hole continues to the fourth hole. By the time he gets to the fourth hole, the numbers were working against him. Too many rounds going downrange, and the North Vietnamese finally got him. They shot him in the face, blew the brains out of the back of his head in that gunfight. But in the process, he saved his unit. And for his incredible courage, he was awarded the Medal of Honor and is the only Medal of Honor recipient from Philadelphia. So, I want to tell you, and we were just looking, this all comes from the book, No Greater Love. I read the book, I interviewed the family, and I'm going to share some of that with you here today. But one very important part of this book is the list of all the men who received the Medal of Honor on that same day. And these stories of these men doing these incredible things, and I hope we have time to get to it because there's a pattern there. It's incredible. Why did they do it? What makes them think and act like that? Well, it's that reasoning that I am so passionate about these stories and sharing with you the type of men that we're talking about. Let's get back to the Crescents family. Tight group, Catholic family from Philadelphia. Mike's little brother, Joe, has been responsible for doing everything he can to make sure that this story of Michael's isn't a story that's forgotten. The story is now memorialized in this fantastic book, No Greater Love, The Story of Michael Crescents. I had this incredible honor of interviewing Joe and Valerie Crescents, as well as the book's co-author, Kevin Ferris. I began the interview with what I believe is probably the most painful memory for Joe Crescents. It was the day the knock at the door came. Saturday morning, would have been late 1968. Saturday morning, Joe was just 12 years old, and it was about to become a very bad day for the Crescents family. For one, Joe learned his brother died. Secondly, now would begin years of watching his family, particularly his mother, grieve, and their lives would never be the same after that day. Tyler, if we can play clip one, please. This is Joe talking about that knock at the door that day, talking about the impact on his family.
That day, that Saturday morning, getting ready for my bowling meeting with the Ogotts Boys Club up at the old Stanton Lanes, which is in the other side of our old neighborhood of the West Oak Lane, East Germantown section of Philadelphia. And my dad was going to take me up to the bowling lanes, and he was up at the top of the steps where the main bathroom was, in the only bathroom of a family of seven men and one woman. So that was a typical row home type of living in a city. Pop was up shaving, getting ready to take me to the bowling lanes after I was with him and Mom. Mom was in the kitchen. There was a knock on the door roughly around, I'd say approximately 7 o'clock, 7:05 that Saturday morning. I answered the door. It was latter part of November. I answered the door. There was a young man in his class A's, as the servicemen would say, of the Army, standing there, opened up the door, and he asked, "Is this the Crescents, however you want to pronounce the way of his name, residence?" I said, "Yes, sir." "Said, is your mother and father home?" I said, "Yes, sir." "You'll have to try and get one of the parents. I need to talk to him." I said, "No problem." So while I was not letting the guy in from the Army yet into the living room, my pop was yelling from the down the steps, the top of the steps, "Who the hell is at the door at this time of the morning?" I said, "Yo, Dad, it's a guy from the Army." In the back part of the house where the kitchen was, Mom dropped the iron, skillet. She was cooking us some breakfast. She knew exactly what happened. Mothers know. And that was the problem during that era. There were two other young men from our neighborhood that were also killed in action right around that time frame, 67, 68, unfortunately. And that was the news that no parent wants to hear. I just to this day, that poor young man from the Army, I don't even know how he did his job. This poor kid couldn't look more than 19, 20 years of age himself, delivering that news to a set of parents. There's that memory. It's emblazed into your head. You can't ever forget it.
I want you to understand that this was a tight Catholic family. And at that moment, their world just got rocked, and they didn't even realize it yet. I believe his mother did know, but she had no idea the journey they were about to take. And I promise you that Joe Crescents hates the sound of somebody knocking at the door all these years later. I'll bet you it still makes him wince. And part of the reason was because Michael was so loved and so respected. Listen to what his brother Joe says about him here in clip two.
He was about seven and a half years older than I. He was a character. He was a heck of an athlete, played all the sports like most of the guys did in the neighborhood during the seasons. He loved baseball. Heck of a baseball player. Could hit a ball like nobody's business. Heck of a basketball player. He actually never played for the high school team, but they had what they call a recreation. Him and I think the five or six guys that he grew up with played from junior high all the way through high school in this type of rec league. They were pretty good athletes, these guys. I also played a lot of sandlot football like those guys did back then. He didn't play for the high school team. The only sport he did was baseball with my oldest brother, Charlie, who was also a Vietnam veteran, combat Marine himself, who passed away 5 years ago, unfortunately, Charlie, from the Agent Orange and the effects of age. But anyway, Mike was well-respected in the neighborhood because of his athletic. Like, and also, from what I was told, he was always very, very handsome guy. So the young ladies at the time swooned over him, from what I gathered. But he was a great brother. He actually was the one that showed me how to hit the baseball proper, you know, my proper stance at the plate. And also, I'll never forget this. I had to be maybe about seventh grade. He took me up the bowling lane on his date with his then girlfriend, who was going to become his fiance, which we didn't know at that time. He really loved this girl. He must have really liked me, because he let me tag along and bowl with those two for his big date night up at the bowling lane. So how many big brothers were going to have a little scraggly guy 7.5 years younger tag along with him and his girlfriend? That was pretty cool.
I got to tell you, reading through the book, it's not an isolated story. You know, you'll hear people, they want to memorialize their dead brother. They're going to tell you all the good stories. I'm going to tell you, the guy's the real deal. Everybody loved Michael. This just seemed like an all-around great guy. At one point in the interview, I said to Joe, I said, this is a really fantastic story, but I got to tell you, it's about polar opposite of my relationships with my brothers and my family. All we did was beat the bananas out of each other. And of course, they were brothers, and Joe did reveal a little bit of some of the shenanigans that went on. Clip three, please.
And the one thing they did for me when I got a little smart with Mom, when they needed to get a favor from Mom to go to Dad to soften the blow, you know, Mom always was a sucker for that, that the boys would defend Mom, Charlie and Mike especially. They get those high school rings they had from our high school and planted one right on my head a couple times. and possibly, maybe that's why Val considers I'm ADHD. I don't know. Maybe that's what. Who the heck knows? But, you know, you look back, I never change a thing. We had a good growing up.
I thought it's amazing testimony. And Joe did go on to say that the older brothers, Michael and Charlie, would fight. But they always took care of the younger siblings. I mean, they wouldn't let anybody else beat up on them. And there was a code in the hood. I grew up not too far away, so I know a little bit about it. And our family had a similar dynamic, even if it was just a little bit different. But that day that the knock on the door came, it created more questions than answers. And all they knew at that point was that Michael was dead. And soon all this was going to hit home for them in a very, very real way, because they needed to bury Michael. In clip four, Michael comes home.
So this occurred November of 68. I'd say it was the end of November 68 that I do believe his remains came back and, of course, went down to Dover Air Base. I do believe, and I can't say for certain, that my father, mother, and Charlie, like most Vietnam casualties, the families, it was too hectic. Nobody went down to Dover Air Base, as far as I knew. The Army contacted, of course, the family, saying when he was going to be down on U.S. soil, meaning Dover, where would you like to have Michael's remains to go, meaning what funeral pile? All I remember, it was the Fitzpatrick Funeral Home down on South Broad Street. Now, what neighborhood? I couldn't tell you, because there were a few different Fitzpatrick funeral homes. Charlie had to go with Pop, because the Army told our parents, and Pop did not want to believe them, that the body was unviewable. Do not attempt to open up the casket when the body is remaining. So Charlie had to make sure that Pop wasn't going to do something rash when the remains got to the funeral pile. I do remember Charlie telling me this years later, that he had to tell Pop, you don't want to remember Michael this way. You just want to remember him, you know, how he was. You know, why would you want to have a view of a body that's mangled and blown apart, I'm sure, because later I could tell people what was described to me, what took Michael down years later at a reunion through the medic that was there at that battle, Dockstown, lives up in the East Hamptons in Long Island. So that's, you know, that's another thing if you want to ask. But, it, you know, to answer your question about, you know, Pop, you know, in the time frame that the body, the remains came home, I'd say it was about a week and a half, because they said that the jungle was so harsh, trying to preserve the remains was a real mess. And could you imagine, you know, Chris and of course, Kevin being a veteran himself, could you imagine that was your MOS, doing that more duty? I can't even imagine that. So there it is.
This strong family foundation that they had and the close relationships made Michael's death even harder. And you're going to find this interesting dichotomy throughout the story that, you know, things that you would normally celebrate, and in some ways they did at the same time, were a great source of pain for the family. And Joe talks about this a little bit in clip 5, the impact on the family.
Dad was proud of watching his boys play ball. But as he got older, my two little brothers never had that chance. You know, my brother Steve and Chris after me, they didn't have the chance to have Pop and Mom really watch them play organized sports because the neighborhood had changed so much. It was a little bit of chaotic mess in our neighborhoods in Philly at that time. So they didn't get a chance to have Mom and Dad really watch play, especially Dad. He was getting older. He was worn down. Yeah, he was never the same. He kept it close to the vest, as they say, Chris. Dad never spoke of it, at least to any of his sons. We still, to this day, he took it to the grave what he did in Europe. He served 23 months on his DD-214. He served in European campaigns, but it doesn't state where it was or what he did. Kept that first man. Now, these men just want to come on home and start their family. Forget it.
So Michael was brought home, buried in a Catholic cemetery, which is right at the edge of Philadelphia in Montgomery County. The family, after that, got several letters that I'm aware of, talked about in the book. One of them was from the commanding officer, from Michael's commanding officer. And he was speaking in very general terms, but he referred highly to Michael's bravery. But the family, they still didn't understand the magnitude of the events that took place on that day. Can you imagine not knowing at this point? It wasn't the main focus of our interview, but Joe did hint at some of the challenges that the family had processing all this. The father and three of the brothers were also veterans. Three of the four also combat veterans. These were tough people, a tough family, but this tore them to pieces, and they never stopped loving Michael, never once. Then another knock at the door came. This time, inviting the Crescents family to the White House. They learned that Michael was being awarded the Medal of Honor, an incredible honor, the highest honor indeed, but it was also a burden for a few reasons. One that Joe talks about, the parents didn't want to bring up memories for the families of the missing soldiers. They were so proud of Michael, but they kept it quiet out of respect for others and the fact that it was such a symbol of pain for them. Here you'll hear clip 6. We'll talk about the Medal of Honor.
But one of the guys was a veteran and a friend of Charlie's. And many years after they had both served, he came by the house one day to pick up Charlie. They were going to go down the shore together. As he was waiting in the front room, he saw this something framed on the wall and he walked over to it. And it was the Medal of Honor. And all of a sudden, he hears someone come up behind him, and it's Mrs. Crescents. And now he knew that Michael had passed, but he didn't know Michael had the medal. But and the first thing that he blurts out is, "Oh, Mrs. Crescents, I didn't know," meaning about the medal, not that he had died. And then, and she just started crying. And Charlie just happened to come down the stairs at that moment. And, you know, and the guy remembers him comforting his mom. And then they went off together and didn't say a word about it.
It's amazing when you think about that. Like, if you think from a military perspective, the Medal of Honor is like the king's crown. But the family, they kept it around the corner. Do you understand? They were so sensitive to the rest of the team, the community that they served, and they kept serving him. Many years later, Joe, his brother Joe, never stopped loving his brother Michael, never stopped supporting veterans. Joe Crescents, Michael's brother, was volunteering down at Arlington National Cemetery. And while he was down there, just in a normal course of service, doing his part to serve the community as well, he said, well, What about having my brother moved here? Well, it started a little idea, and it was one that changed the family. We'll hear about in clip 7.
Well, the man says, well, I don't know what the procedure would be, but I'll give you the name of the person at the office. You contact her and go from there, you know, and see what luck you have.
His mom and dad were buried at a veterans cemetery outside of Cape May Courthouse. Nobody was ever going to be buried in Philadelphia with Mike. And it really started to grate on Joe that he would be alone there forever. And, you know, Joe would go and look after the grave, and occasionally he would have to replace the bronze marker that held the flags and that sort of thing. They would disappear. And, you know, he just began to wonder if, you know, what could be done about this. And then when he decided that maybe we could look at Arlington, he asked his brothers, and much to his surprise, they seemed to be okay with that idea.
I think it was a watershed moment for my oldest brother, Charlie, and all, excuse me, all those combat veterans that knew Michael, that played ball with Michael in the neighborhood, the new Charlie. They were pals all those years before they all broke up and went into the military service, wherever they served. I think it was a watershed event for these men and women that served in that era, that it was the funeral that they never could attend to one of their fallen brothers. And Charlie was a different guy after that. He, I think, carried it with him that he felt it was his fault that Michael got killed for whatever reason. Because they were competitive guys. Whatever they did, they were only, what, like 18 months apart. So what was the old expression? They're like Irish twins or something like that. Somebody would say that expression because that's how close they were in age. They were very competitive, you know, in sports.
It was like a weight had been lifted off of him.
Yeah. So Charlie, it was good for him. It was good for Charlie. And probably my brother Pete. You know, Pete, like I said, he just had his own demon. But I do believe. Yeah, Pete was proud, you know, the other two veterans. Now, our brother Steve, right after me, number 5, he was in the Coast Guard during the Cold War. And Steve, to this day, he really doesn't speak much of his service in the Coast Guard. And he didn't know Charlie and Mike as well, because they were young guys, him and Chris, you know, when the action happened, you know. And so it was a good thing for those two young fellas to see how the military and civilians honored their brother Mike when we did take him down to Arlington, because it was a phenomenal experience. You know, what that old guard did for our brother, you know, they, and for anybody that's buried in Arlington, they do it upright. This Sunday, guys, on Mom's Day, it's 16 years when Michael entered Arlington.
Wow.
Yeah, 16 years this Sunday. Yeah. And the weather, like Val just said, it reminded us of that day. It was in the 40s, raining like all get out till we got down there. It was still raining somewhat, but it was a cold, damp day. And all the veterans from Vietnam, it was a big joke among them. They said, your brother's gotten the last laugh on us. The damn monsoons came back. The memories of what those men saw, you know?
Always got to be raining and miserable. I thought that was a nice tie-in. I'm giving you the Cliff Note version here because we only have so much time. But I can't tell you how incredible this story is. It's a captivating story. It'll suck you in, and it's part of history. The book is called No Greater Love. After we talked about Arlington, we switched gears, and Kevin Ferris came on. Kevin is the co-author of the book No Greater Love. And I asked Kevin, I said, why did you write this? Why is this story so important? And here in clip 8, he gives a great answer. Here we go.
Pretty moving, remarkable story just overall. And I'll just circle back a little bit to when you guys were talking about Arlington. Kind of sadly, Michael's story was, except for the family and a few friends, his story was largely forgotten by the larger Philadelphia community. And, you know, Joe's action in remembering his brother and making sure that his sacrifices weren't forgotten just kind of opened the floodgates, because the local veteran community totally adopted Michael as almost a symbol of all of their forgotten brothers and their fallen brothers and sisters. And so there was Arlington, and then there was the statue, and then the renaming of the VA hospital. Just a total turnaround in how the community views this heroic Native son, all because of Joe. The purpose of the book is to remember, as the title reflects, and as I think as we talk about in the last chapter, there are people who are so loving, so committed to their family and their community and their country that they are willing to sacrifice everything for them. In Michael's time, that day came down to sacrificing himself for the men who were around him and saving their lives. But, and you know, you mentioned earlier, Michael would want the other Medal of Honor recipients remembered. I think that's true of pretty much all Medal of Honor recipients, that, you know, they don't carry the medal because of what they did. They carry it in trust for all the people who have sacrificed for their country and, you know, and lost everything. And they are so blessed to still be around and to carry that legacy forward and help other people remember. So I hope the book is a little bit of that, helping people remember the what people are willing to do for others, and that, you know, that's something they can do. These aren't extraordinary people. These are ordinary men and women who have done extraordinary things, and something we're all capable of. The title is No Greater Love. And I think that came through every single interview. People just loved him. And he just reflected that back on people, whether it's his best buddies, his girlfriend. We kind of closed with a letter from one of his cousins who just remembers how graceful he was and how kind he was to her. So I just felt like, you know, and between that and working with Joe and Val, it just felt like an honor every time I sat down to work on this. And it was just like, we got to get this done. We got to get it right. And we got to get it out there.
Man, I couldn't agree more. I was so happy I asked Kevin that question. And I was so happy with the answer and not even really surprised at all. It was such an honor for me to speak with his family and to speak about this story of Corporal Crescens. And, you know, you get a little sense. You hear about the younger brother, much younger. You know, he would have barely known Michael and later went in to serve in the Coast Guard. And he won't even speak about it. And I can understand why. It's out of respect for his brother. It's because you say, look, anything that anybody else did compared to this guy, there's no comparison. And it becomes hard to be in the same room, if you understand what I'm saying. But to have a few minutes to tell this story, it really is an incredible hallowed ground, really. And I felt the same way as Kevin in participating in this. The book is just really incredible. It tells the story of the family, the communication, the dedication to service. And it also tells the complete details of exactly what happened to Michael that day, where the unit was and who the other members of the unit were, and also what was going on there in terms of what they were involved with. I mentioned earlier a little bit about the story about the dock, and you've heard us talk on different shows about the dock or the corpsman, as we call them in the Marine Corps. And you've heard that these guys are very revered in the units, and for good reason, right? My mother used to have a saying, don't bite the hand that feeds you. Take care of the dock because he's going to take care of you. Well, you're not going to hear from this guy. You heard Joe mention that he lives not far from here. I think he said New York. But he's not going to tell his story. He won't speak of it. I think Joe even mentioned that he's tried a few times to reach out, and the doc won't say too much. Need to understand for the doc, you know, doc probably literally messed his pants on that day, probably literally urinated and defecated himself because he was so scared. He's watching the guy that he's holding get blown to freaking pieces. Becomes a little bit difficult to talk about these things. This guy comes along, Michael Crescens, and says, I got this. It was like Doc thought that he saw God himself on that battlefield. You understand? And it probably was a spiritual experience for him in every way. But it's phenomenal the sacrifice that these corpsmen, these docs, and everything that they do it embodies everything about Michael. Doc probably should have had his own honor that day, and maybe he did receive some kind of accolade. I didn't get a chance to look into that, but he would deserve it as well. There's another part of the book, and it pays it back. It's a huge tribute to all the Vietnam veterans and all the Medal of Honor winners, even listing all the citations that were awarded on the day that Michael received his. The book is about Michael, but they included in the book all the citations for all the other Medals of Honor awarded that day. They would not do it for Michael alone. Why? Because he was a brother to the Army, too, and they never forgot that. Well, then comes along this idea of naming the Philadelphia Veterans Hospital after Michael and a statue at the Vietnam Memorial. Here's clip 9. Listen to what Joe says about this.
Finally meet this Frank Tacy, because an email, emails don't do it. You got to meet the person face to face. So I finally did. So fast forward to December of 2010, the year before in 2009, December 2009, I went down to Arlington for the Rees Across America. I actually got my brother Charlie and his good buddy from the New Jersey State Troopers, Charlie's neighbor, Ray Miller, who served in the Air Force during the Nam era. He was never in Nam, but he served our country. He was a state trooper with Charlie. Up, and they live in the same block up in Toms River, New Jersey, Island Heights here. Those two guys met me down there in December 2009. I thought, oh, this is great. You know, America's what a place. You know, people came from all over our country to help put Reeves on the tombstones down Arlington. So the following year, I found out Frank Tacy wanted to meet me down there with another Vietnam vet that he grew up with in the Bridesburg, I think the Bridesburg section of Philadelphia. And Frank says, how about if I meet you, and I forget the other veteran's name now, down such and such a spot, down there close to where Michael's buried, we'll meet there. Sure. So while we were waiting on the tractor trail from Reeves Across America to come on into the sections of the cemetery to distribute the Reeves for us people to put gravestones. He asked me this question, what would you and your brothers think if I initiate to get the Philadelphia VA renamed after your brother? Now I looked at him. I said, really? Are you that crazy? He says, no, this is my mission. What you did for your brother a year and a half ago or less than 2 years ago, 2008. He says, that inspired me to do something with my life more than what I've been doing. I said, Frank, if you want to do it, God bless you, but don't count on me and my brothers to get involved because we're just following what our mother and father did for their son. They never bragged about their son, never told anybody unless they asked what Michael did. They kept it to themselves. The Crescens family never got involved, and people may not believe us, did not get involved with any of these renaming, including the statue that was put down. And I'll talk about that. You're asking me about the statue down at the wall, the Philadelphia Vietnam. We didn't have anything to do with it. It was all the Vietnam veterans because they were so disgusted at what the government did to them. They said, piss on them. We're going to get this done. Come hell or high water. So that's what Frank did. It took him close to, I think, 4.5 years. I say five, but I think it was more like 4 to 4.5 years to get the process done through our Congress.
Do you understand now, listening to that story, why I hate fat generals working for foreign countries when so many veterans, so many families from our own area here in Philadelphia have made these sacrifices? That we have to remember this history. You know why I'm so passionate about it, because there are people that are forgetting it. Think about this a second. We're now, you know, years after Michael's death. He's been moved to Arlington. There was finally some closure. Well, now the rest of the community says, well, we need our closure. We want to memorialize this. The family says, that's great, but we're not going to have anything to do with that. Why? Because their foundation, their principles are so strong, they wouldn't even participate in that. When you look at what some others are doing right now, it's really disturbing how they'll take money and they'll make money off of different things and never give back. But let's stick to the story today. This hospital, can you imagine going down there? And there's a giant photographs of your brother. There's your family name on a hospital. This is a whole complex down there. This isn't like a little building on the corner. This is a whole big place down there. The Philadelphia Veterans Hospital is one of the biggest in the country. There's his name. Then you go around the corner. Not really. It's a little ways down the road down at Penn's Landing, the Vietnam War Memorial in Philadelphia. And there's this giant statue of your brother. Can you imagine the pride, the honor? But you know what? These events, they all carry a dual burden, pride and pain. Here we go. Clip 10. Listen to what Joe says about this.
But my wife and I, especially my wife, will volunteer up at the Coatesville VA for our veterans in the nursing home and hospice unit. And I have in the past escorted some of our veterans down to the Philadelphia VA, which is, of course, named after Michael now. And I always am amazed to see his likeness in the different entrances, the two main entrances that you come in on to inside by the VA, and there's his story, and there's his picture, and it's just like it sounds corny, but it's surreal that there's my brother, you know, and it's wow. I would never thought something like this would ever happen because, as I said before, mom and dad kept it to themselves. They didn't make a big deal out of Michael because they felt other parents suffered the same loss and the same grief as they did. And I do believe, that Michael is no better than any other of the men and the women that shed their blood on that soil over there because all their families... were grieving. And I know for a fact my dad was once in a while concerned about what about the parents of the MIAs, which are still, there's plenty of MIAs still from World War II, Korea, Vietnam. So what about those families? They don't have any closure. So we were at least the fortunes. We knew Michael came home. Sounds very harsh, but he came back on U.S. soil.
Wow. I don't know how you not hear that story. It doesn't make an impact on you. The whole interview, we covered a lot, over an hour-long conversation, incredible conversation with incredible people. I want you to know we're going to post the entire audio of that. You can get that at projectchaos.org. We'll have that up in the next day or so. I said it was an honor for me to be a part of this. And I'll tell you, they treated me like royalty as well during the whole interview, the follow-up. I never felt so proud to be a veteran, and I hope I conveyed that here today, as well as adding their words to that. Before we got done, I asked them a final question. I said, you know, it's been a long time, now. Why is this story so important? Listen to what these Americans said in clip 11.
I mentioned this to Joe and Val at one point. I was at a Phillies game just a year or so ago. I think the book had already was done and maybe published. And it just occurred to me that, you know, Michael could be sitting there with his kids and his grandkids. You know, like I was there with my kid at the time and my wife, and he could be there with his whole family. And he, you know, not that much older than me, but he wasn't, because he chose to serve. And on a particular day, he chose to sacrifice everything for the people around him. So that's a lot for him and everybody else who has ever done that. That's why I think the book is important, that just a reminder. Not that, you know, people have to give that much every single day, but you can give a little bit and, you know, make things better for everybody. It was remarkable when, in looking up not just their citations, but everything that has been done for them since, just as Michael's been remembered by Joe and his family and his community, so many of those other Michael's not the only one of those 21 who has a statue up in his community. There are roads named after people. I think one guy's medal was taken up in the space shuttle by someone else from his hometown who went up. Right. People remember that. It was really cool to see how people were remembering these guys in so many different ways. And at the same time, how much they sacrifice for others. Just really remarkable.
Mike's book to me is just another part of our history. Like you said, Chris, these stories have to be told.
You know, because on the surface, you look at it, this guy's been gone for many years. Why would anybody care about his story now? But this is a story about relationships. And at this time in our history, our relationships in this country are fractured and we're so polarized. And this is a story about some guy who, you know, he had all of these different relationships. They all meant something to him. And those people's relationship with Michael meant something to them. And they find commonalities and they find ways to respond to each other. It's that kind of a story. And we need more of that, you know, for people to just look at other people and try to understand them.
No greater love. Tells Michael's story from the perspective of those who loved him most, close friends, family, Michael's commanding officer in Vietnam, retired Lieutenant General Sam Wetzel, and medic William Doc Stafford, the soldier closest to Michael when he was cut down by enemy fire, who believes to this day that he survived that firefight only because of the selfless actions of Private First Class Michael Cressens. I want to tell you a little bit more when we come back. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, I want to tell you why this is so important. See you in a minute. Surveyor, civil engineer, but if you're in business, own property, or developing real estate, you know how critical it is to your project to make sure that you get the best Everything has to be done correctly. It's important that those details are exact to ensure the success of the project. Well, my good friend Michael Tacconelli from STA Engineering is the best there is. It was my first job when I got home from the Marine Corps, working on a survey crew, while Michael back then was the party chief. We hit it off well because of his relentless, disciplined approach. It was something that I agreed with. And I learned a little bit about surveying, an ancient craft that's now done with modern tools, but it still requires a high level of skill and professional expertise. Michael and his team bring all three: skill, expertise, and of course all the latest tools and technology. The entire package of surveying and engineering, allowing them to provide builders and developers, businesses and property owners with reliable survey, design and engineering for land development projects in southeastern Pennsylvania. For your next project, you're going to want to make sure you have the best possible support. Do yourself a favor and hire Michael Tacconelli, STA Engineering. They're already serving some of the area's largest developers, and they've done work in just about every municipality in the county. STA Engineering. Ask for Michael Tacconelli. One of the things that's rewarding for me about producing this show is the historical significance. Imagine getting to know a guy who was with the Marines who landed the first tanks in Vietnam. It's an incredible story, the power and capability of Marine Expeditionary Brigades. And Joe Tyson Sr. was there, literally, the first tanks off the boat and onto the beaches of Vietnam. The deployment came as a surprise, and they had no idea how long it would last. He ended up there an incredible 18 months, all detailed and chronicled in 600 pages of powerful warfighting stories from the perspective of a ground-fighting combat Marine. He tells it all. A real inside look at the conflict, the campaigns, and the crews. A look inside the fighting spirit of the Marine Corps. Joe Tyson Sr. says it all. It's a book that you'll want to have in your personal library. It's called Unfortunate Sons. It's available on Amazon. Check it out. Unfortunate Sons. We had an opportunity to interview Joe here at our studio at WWDB. It was an incredible experience. You can listen to the interview at projectchaos.org. Don't forget to check out the book, Unfortunate Sons, by Joe Tyson Sr., available on Amazon. I want to take a moment to share a little personal recommendation with you. Although I've spoken at quite a few events now, I didn't have any good video of me actually speaking in front of people. When we scheduled the book tour, I wanted to get some good video. Well, we reached out to a company called MAV, stands for Media, Art, and Video. I'm going to tell you, if you need any video, print design, or art, I highly recommend you take a look at what they have to offer at officialmav.com. That's officialmav.com. Media, Art, and Video. They did a great job for us. Of course, they covered all the basics of being there on time, highly organized and ready for the event. But they really went above and beyond, capturing great video, making adjustments where needed, making sure that the final product was a perfect 10. I'm happy to say they really delivered on that. If you need video of any kind, media, design, be sure to check out officialmav.com. That's officialmav.com. All right, we don't have a lot of time left, and we're not going to get to everything I wanted to get to today, but that's fine. I said to you I wanted to tell you why this is so important, why these stories are so important, why this piece of the story is so important. Well, I'm going to tell you a few names here to put a little name to this. I want to tell you a little bit more about the sacrifice that was made from all the Medal of Honor recipients mentioned in the book, give you a little glimpse into that. And then I'm hoping to have just a minute to tell you why the service and the commitment of these Vietnam veterans is so important to me personally. Let me start with this. I served with Alpha Battery, 1st Battalion, 12th Marines. And around 1966, 1967, the unit was a little bit different than what I served in. Back in 66, 67, it was a mortar battery. 1st Battalion, 12th Marine Regiment, part of the 3rd Marine Division, Whiskey 112, it was called. Well, a few of them gave their lives in Vietnam. Staff Sergeant Melvin Douglas Holcomb, July 6, 1967. Corporal Sylvester McNeil, July 6, 1967. PFC Roland Dummond, July 6, 1967. PFC Thomas Joseph Sidlow, July 25th, 1967. Corporal Benny Lee West, September 1st, 1967. Lance Corporal Clinton Rhodes, September 1st, 1967. PFC David Showweiler, September 19th, 1967. Second Lieutenant Cole Herndon, September 11th, 1968. HM2 Cecil Wayne Carruthers, September 11th, 1968. PFC Jerry Wayne Glaze, December 4th, 1968. PFC Samuel Ismail Jose Valdez Jr., May 2nd, 1968. All brothers from my unit that were killed in Vietnam. Before I was even born, these deaths all occurred. Amazing history when you think about it. You heard from what we talked about from the interview how important it was to the family and to Michael that these other Medal of Honor recipients be recognized, that it was more important that they receive recognition than the Crescent's family. That's their commitment to service. But what I want to turn your attention to right now is the character of the men that they're speaking of. It's key in everything that I've said to you about remembering our history, why this is so important, and why it's so important that we have men like this in our society. Listen to what they did. I'm not going to get to all of them, but you're going to get an idea of the pattern. Lieutenant Fortnett used his body as a shield in front of a mine as he attempted to cut the wires to the mine, shielding it from the enemy positions. As he reached for the wire, the mine was detonated, killing him instantly. Five men nearest the mine were slightly wounded, but First Lieutenant Fortnett's heroic and unselfish act spared his men of serious injury or death. Let me tell you what really happened. He walked up, cut the wire, it blew his body to pieces, and all those pieces landed on the guys that he just saved. That's what they're living with every day, wiping his remains off of their face. Sergeant First Class Yano from Hawaii, where I was stationed. This story is amazing. This guy was a crew chief on a helicopter, an air winger. A grenade comes inside. He starts fighting back, right? What does it say here? From an exposed position in the face of intense small arms and anti-aircraft fire, he delivered suppressive fire upon the enemy forces and marked their positions with smoke and white phosphorus grenades, enabling his troop commander to direct accurate and effective artillery fire against hostile emplacements. But this story makes an ugly turn. A grenade, presumably one that he was launching, exploded prematurely, covering him with burning phosphorus and left him severely wounded. You get a picture of what's going on there? Then flaming fragments from within the helicopter caused supplies and ammunition to detonate. Dense white smoke filled the aircraft, obscuring the pilot's vision and causing him to lose control. Although having the use of only one arm and being partially blinded by the initial explosion, Sergeant First Class Yano completely disregarded his welfare and began hurling blazing ammunition from the helicopter. In doing so, he inflicted additional wounds upon himself, yet he persisted until the danger was past. Yano's indomitable courage and profound concern for his comrades averted a loss of life and additional injury to the rest of the crew. Team Delta was in a defensive perimeter conducting reconnaissance of enemy trail networks when a member of the team detected enemy movement to the front. As Staff Sergeant Rabble and a comrade prepared to clear the air, he heard an incoming grenade as it landed in the midst of the team's perimeter. With complete disregard for his own life, Staff Sergeant Rabble threw himself on the grenade, covering it with his body, receiving the complete impact of the immediate explosion. Specialist Keidenberg, 21 years old, from Brooklyn. He's another one like Crescens. They're pinned down badly, and this guy runs through the fire. If you've ever heard small arms fire, it's just crack, 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 and you don't know where it's coming from. It takes a special kind of nerve, a special kind of resolve to get up and run through that. Here's Staff Sergeant Marvin Young as a human wave attack advanced on Staff Sergeant Young's platoon. He moved from position to position, encouraging and directing fire on the hostile insurgents while exposing himself to the hail of enemy bullets. After receiving orders to withdraw to a better defensive position, he remained behind to provide covering fire. Another story that repeats itself. Sergeant McKibben, deploying his men to covered positions, observed one of his men fall to the ground. Although the bullets were hitting all around the wounded man, Sergeant McKibben, with complete disregard for his safety, sprang to his comrade's side and under heavy enemy fire pulled him to safety. Sergeant Rourke was the point squad leader of a small force which had a mission of rescuing 11 men in a hilltop observation post under heavy attack by a company-sized force approximately 1,000 meters from the battalion perimeter. As lead elements of the release force reached the besieged observation post, intense automatic weapons fire from the enemy-occupied bunkers halted their movement. Without hesitation, Sergeant Rourke maneuvered his squad, repeatedly exposing himself to enemy fire to hurl grenades and direct the fire of his squad to gain fire superiority and cover the withdrawal of the outpost and evacuation of the casualties. Frustrated in their effort to overrun the position, the enemy swept the hilltop with small arms and volleys of grenades. Seeing a grenade land in the midst of his men, Sergeant Rourke, with complete disregard for his safety, hurled himself on the grenade. How many guys hurling themselves on grenades? Sergeant Stone, similar story. There was over 20 of them awarded that day. I want to tell you this, why it means so much to me personally. I'll see if I can capture this for you quickly. Grab the book from casematepublishers.com, No Greater Love. Thank you, Joe and Valerie Crescens and Kevin Ferris. Listen, the reflection of so many incredible Vietnam veterans had a huge impact on me. My first sergeant, First Sergeant Bratcher, Staff Sergeant Sylvester, our first section chief. I'll never forget those guys, Vietnam veterans that made sure that we never had to deal with what they had to deal with. They would never let that happen. We'll be back next week. Hope to see you there.